5 years ago, it was big news here in town that a notoriously run-down, low-income housing complex on Independence Avenue would be coming down and an ambitious new project would be created to replace it. This project would be more than just a building. It would be a whole ecosystem for the historic Northeast neighborhood to thrive, and it would include affordable housing. But it would also be more than that. Today is the official ribbon cutting for one piece of the Paseo Gateway project, a mixed-use apartment building, with one-third of the units reserved for low-income tenants and all of the units designed with the needs of artists in mind. So shared studio space, special sinks for draining art materials, and yes, affordable rent, even a gallery. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to hear about the thinking behind what's been dubbed the Pendleton Arts Block on KCUR's Central Standard. My first guest is David Brint. He's with the developer behind this project. He's based in Chicago, and he's here in town for the ribbon cutting. David, good morning.
Good morning.
So Kansas City's Housing Authority was able to pursue this project thanks to a fiercely competitive grant from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The question is, what makes housing for artists so valuable, not just for artists, but for a neighborhood, even a city?
Well, artists tend to develop organically. Artists tend to move into neighborhoods and start to have an influence. And in the Pendleton Heights neighborhood in particular, there was a lot of that organic development. And one of the things that we thought about in terms of using the Choice Neighborhood Grant to secure neighborhood development was to say, let's take advantage of that organic development, concentrate it, and we created Arts Block.
Okay, so explain the concept for the Pendleton Arts Block and where housing for artists fits into that vision.
So Pendleton Arts Block, it sits right on Independence. It sits next to the Northeast Community Center and across from Samuel Rogers and a charter school. And the idea is that we create energy in the neighborhood by having the artists come together and live in this similar space. And we make it an active neighborhood center. There's exhibition space that's being programmed by Arts Asylum. And there are we have a program with Charlotte Street Foundation that they have three commercial spaces that they started a startup residency program, and three local organizations will have use of that space for the first year and possibly 2 years to try to help apprentice artists develop. So they create a little bit of an energy in that node of development, or where we've had several other developments there.
You know, it's interesting because Pendleton Heights isn't a place I think of as particularly not energetic already.
It's right. There's a lot of things going on there. There's a lot of people from different countries there. There's a beautiful housing stock there, but there have been, it has been run down. It hasn't seen a lot of investment, and we are trying to use the Choice Neighborhood Grant to coalesce that development, to encourage other development in addition to what's already going on in the neighborhood.
So this is modeled after something that's already been done in Chicago.
We have done several projects in Chicago, one of which won a big national award from HUD called Dorchester Artist Housing. We did that program with an artist named Theaster Gates, who's a pretty famous artist around the country.
Very big deal.
Yeah, and Theaster, we coalesced his expertise, University of Chicago artist in residency, into this development, and helped coalesce the neighborhood to use that as a focal point for activities. One time I had a friend said they wanted to go by there, and I was going to set it up for him, but he went by on a Sunday afternoon and he had texted me on his way, and I thought, oh boy, he's not going to see anything. And sure enough, he got there. There was a yoga class going on. There were people that have come from all over the city. And so it's pretty energetic space.
You know, I read some about that project, and Theaster Gates, one of the things that seemed to interest him about the particular neighborhood was that it was a neighborhood that had some energy historically, mm-hmm. and that the prevailing wisdom in a particular moment of urban development was go somewhere better if you can. And that he wanted to not create energy out of nothing, but to say, like, if we just open these spaces back up, they are beautiful and they contain sort of like the love of history and like the energy of the people who made them what they are. If you just open them back up and breathe life into them again, that they will kind of take off on their own.
He'd love you. You got it. That's exactly the way he looks at things. And in this case, that's what we did here. We took an old public housing project that was dormant. It was closed. It was a nuisance in the neighborhood. And we made it into
And that seemed to be something that like the tenants agreed about that probably more than anyone.
Oh, the tenants came back. They had already been displaced. But if you see the way the artist center was built, we used a lot of materials that were taken from the neighborhood. You know, other buildings that were torn down, factories that had been gone, and bricks that were basically being thrown away. He reuses a lot of materials.
So what's unique about the Kansas City project as you think about that there is this model of success with the sort of like bigger concept in Chicago, but Kansas City's project clearly has its own flavor and its own challenges?
Well, Kansas City has a thriving arts community, and as it has developed in different parts of the city and you know, in the Crossroads and others. And so in this case, being able to bring them into the Paseo, into the Pendleton Heights neighborhood in a way that creates affordable housing, creates space for them to operate, helps to give it more of a personality. And remember that the right across the street is the Northeast Community Center and Harmony Place. I don't know if you're familiar with Harmony Place, but they operate a program for young children to put music in their hands, put instruments in their hands from the time they're very young. And they have an amazing success rate of about 80% of their children graduate high school that work through the program.
So the fact that artists are already fleeing other parts of town to come live in Pendleton Heights, and just the historic Northeast in general seems to be sort of a destination for artists who have been priced out elsewhere. Was that a significant consideration?
Well, certainly. And part of what we're doing is creating an affordable housing project that will stay permanently affordable. So when Pendleton Heights begins to develop, you know, that's what happens, is that the area's gentrified, rents go up, and artists may not necessarily be able to stay there. We want to create something that will continually allow them to live in an affordable place.
I understand that you worked very closely over a long period of time with the residents of the neighborhood to gather input. What did you learn?
A great deal. I mean, the residents were involved in the design of the project. So there are components in the project that are strictly with the residents. You know, there's all concrete floors. There's different kinds of sound attenuation added to the project.
Why?
Because artists are sometimes messy and sometimes noisy. And, since this development is not necessarily just for visual artists or musical artists or, painting artists, we had to accommodate all kinds of folks.
So why the interest in artists in the bigger scheme of things, like in a project specifically designed to inject a neighborhood with vitality while also providing housing and resources, kind of a launching pad for low-income Kansas Cityans, regardless of whether they're artists?
Now remember, this is the project is based on replacing public housing. So we took down Choteau Courts, and the residents of Choteau Courts have the right to live in the different developments that we're creating. One of the things that we saw when the Kansas City Housing Authority spoke to their residents was there was a sizable number of people that viewed themselves as artists. Some practiced, some were in nascent stages, but viewed themselves as artists. So we were able to provide housing for them in an environment that they could be nurtured in and stay. And then when you mix that with unrestricted units where anybody can come, any income level can come in, and other low-income units for artists, you can create a vitality in the project.
I want to bring another voice in on this. We're joined now by the author of an article with a provocative headline, "Why Artist Housing is Just Another Kind of Affordable Housing." It appeared in Curbed, a website all about city planning. Patrick Sisson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Could you quickly recap the premise of your article?
The basic premise is just that we have an affordable housing shortage across the nation in just about every city. And the idea that, artists need housing is, the entire workforce needs housing. Teachers need housing. Workers need housing. And this is just another way to help add to the general affordable housing stock.
One of the ideas here is that cities right now are competing for assets that lure people, and especially mm-hmm. young people, because that is what makes a city have a future. And so when you don't have a cultural scene to speak of, you don't have that kind of capital.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of a on a bigger sort of city level, there's this creative class thesis, something that Richard Florida, an urbanist, and others have kind of coined. You know, this idea that, you know, in an information age economy, cities need innovation, creativity, an art scene, a tech scene. That's what sort of helps develop jobs in the economy. So that's one of the reasons, in addition to sort of obviously the cultural benefits, that cities are making it a priority to support artists and artist housing. You know, in addition, artists and the arts are a huge driver for the economy. Figures from 2015 show that they pumped about $63.8 billion at the economy, supported 2.3 million jobs. You know, this isn't just arts for art's sake. This really does help the wider community.
One of your sources in your article is quoted as saying that cities, and in this case he was talking about New Orleans, but that cities in general are in danger of, quote, killing the goose that laid the golden egg by driving artists out of the heart of the city and removing them from the fabric of communities. So, like, that it's, you've already kind of lost something if artists are commuting, like, for their shows from some suburb or nearby commuter town.
Yeah, right. There's sort of this vitality, this, part of the idea is, like, you know, you can bump into people or you can, like, experience this art and you can experience something reflecting the community where you live. And, you know, it does make things incredibly exciting and vital. And you think about, you know, music scenes of the last 40 or 50 years and how they're so associated with different cities. And you look at the example of a city like San Francisco, where because of, you know, incredible increases in rents and property values and things like that, so many artists can't afford to live in a city that was once kind of a haven for it. And you even have things like the ghost ship fire in Oakland, where artists who were trying to find an affordable place to live ended up in a place that was not very safe because it was one of the only affordable options they had. So there are a lot of sort of issues and sort of quality of life issues that come when artists, you know, can't afford to be in the community.
And then there's just that difference, I feel like, between having the product of artists in a city and having art that is generated in that city. You know, we did a show not long ago on whether Kansas City is a good place to be starting out as a young artist. And what we heard from all of our guests is that affordable housing is the biggest hurdle to clear right now if you want mm-hmm. to exist in a way that leaves room for that experimentation and growth, particularly before you've hit your stride.
Yeah, very true. And I think it's also just important to underscore that, you know, we're talking about artists here, but this issue of affordability, this affects so many people across the country. This is really a nationwide crisis. And it's why you see, in addition to sort of these artist housing concepts, you see a lot of teachers housing concepts, because teachers are having trouble affording rent in cities like San Francisco and New York and things like that. So
depressing.
Yeah, it's tough.
Well, if you are an artist, we want to hear from you. What does an opportunity like this mean for you and your community? And what about it might give you pause? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking today about the Pendleton Arts Block. It's a new development in the city's historic northeast that provides affordable housing as well as housing for artists, although those are often the same thing. And we're hearing what the thinking is behind providing a housing complex with an eye toward artists as residents. I'm joined by David Brint of the Brinshore firm behind the project. He's based in Chicago, but he's here today for the ribbon cutting. Hi again, David.
Hi.
And we've got a city planning commentator on the line. He's written an article asserting that cities have something valuable to gain by making sure that artists can afford to stay. He extends that argument to making sure that, say, teachers can afford to stay. Patrick Sisson, welcome back.
Thank you.
You can join this conversation about affordable housing and what it could mean for artists and, by extension, for our city. We want especially to hear from artists on this. 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCURCST. David, tell me about the Choice Neighborhoods Implementation Grant the city got for this project. It is beyond competitive.
It was very competitive. There were 33 applicants from around the country for $30 million to revitalize a neighborhood. It's different from a lot of HUD programs in that it looks at a holistic view of neighborhood development. It looks at schools and health outcomes and social services and housing.
There were, what, four of these to go around?
At the time when we received them, there were five. This year, there were four. Generally, the competition is significant. It's been an extraordinarily successful program if you look at other cities.
This is significant, then, on a national scale, what we're doing here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Secretary Castro came here when he made the announcement for the year at Samuel Rogers Center. It was a big deal. There was national press. And the city and Kansas City Housing Authority did an amazing job partnering to put that application together and make a compelling case.
What do you foresee as the most significant challenges for the project's overall success in terms of the goals it has set for itself going forward?
Do you mean Arts Block or CNI in total?
Arts Block.
The challenges are maintaining long-term energy, making sure that the programming stays vital, making sure that we communicate within the neighborhood to make it a place in the neighborhood that is a focal point for artist activity. It's easy to build a building and then start to manage it and look on to your next project. But in this case, we don't do that. Our local folks, led by Todd Lieberman, spends a lot of time there, knows a lot of the people, and is really committed to the Pendleton Hearts neighborhood. Pendleton Heights neighborhood.
The Crossroads was really lauded as a development success story for a long time in that it was, quote, organic and artist-led. What does it take for a city or a developer to be intentional about something like this without creating something so contrived, and forgive that word, but so contrived that artists are turned off by it?
That's a really good question. It takes a lot of work within the artist community so that you don't build something that you think would be good for them as opposed to what they're telling you they need. And that's what we did.
Yeah. You've given the example of cement floors. Can you give another example before we turn to we've got a caller at 816-235-2888.
The way the common area space was created with certain kinds of lighting so that the exhibition space could be used, access to the building from the outside so that it could be used as a community space, because you have to make sure that the rest of the building's secure. There were dozens of things.
Let's talk to David, who is calling us from Kansas City, to talk about what this kind of a project means in the Kansas City that exists for artists today. Hi, David.
Good morning, Gina.
What do you want to share?
Well, it's a crucial time in our town, and I want to commend your guests on their thoughtful approach to it. I'm a former member of the Municipal Art Commission and someone who helped start the Crossroads 30, 40 years ago. It used to be a great town to make art, but not necessarily a great town to be an artist. And it seems as if there's been a shift now where it's a great town to be an artist, but not necessarily to make art. And I'd hate to see us throw away the respect of other cities with a lower common denominator instead of searching for what art does, which is to uplift people. It uplifts neighborhoods as well, but it starts with an individual relationship with the medium.
David, I want to say that I recognize your voice, and it could be that you would like to just speak as an artist named David. Would you like me to acknowledge who you are and ask you some?
Well, yeah, my name is David Ford, and I moved in the Crossroads in 1984 on 18th Street. I owned a somewhat legendary snack bar called YJ's for over 20 years, and I've had a particularly good vantage point in both working with the city and as a working artist around the country to sample
and with a staff of working artists.
Compare. Pardon?
And with a staff of working artists and a clientele of working artists to sort of have
absolutely.
Perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, many of my projects are civic oriented. My staff could walk to work. But that's a part of it. You've got to mix in, the cafes and the galleries with the the car mechanic shop and the barber shop. Art can have people from all walks of life respond to it, and the better the art or the more poignant the statement, then the more fruitful the endeavor.
David, can you explain what you mean by Kansas City being not a great place to make art?
Well, some of it is the critical conversation, the lack of any real peer review through journals or trade magazines, the utter collapse of the Kansas City Star's arts coverage, the diaspora of what were little pocket neighborhoods into across the city. It's harder to get a critical mass relative to the creative community.
Well, David, thank you for that call.
Yeah, absolutely, Gina.
And now I want to turn to Doug calling from Edwardsville, Kansas. Hi, Doug.
Hi.
Yeah, what do you want to share?
Well, I had a question. I'm 61 years old. I'm a musician. And I thought being in a setting with other artist types would be a more inspirational area to pursue my art. I wondered if there was a age limitation.
No.
And I'm 60.
No, not at all.
61 years old.
Well,
not at all. Okay.
You'd be welcome. We're still leasing. If you're interested, if you talk to the producers, we'll give you the information of how to get in touch with us.
Well, David, so this brings up this interesting question of, could there foreseeably be any tension between the idea that this is, on the one hand, a resource for Kansas Cityans who need housing stock once provided by public housing, and that it's also got this focus on artists? Is it hard to serve more than one community at once?
Sure. You know, but nothing's easy. So, you know, we spend a lot of time communicating with our residents and communicating with the neighborhood to help them coalesce. And we'll see. It was successful in two other endeavors in Chicago, and I think it'll be successful here ultimately.
You know, Patrick, I'm curious, as someone who is looking at this question regarding cities generally, the relationship between affordable housing and cities and what they're like, also the relationship between artists and cities and what they're like. What are you hearing in this very specifically Kansas City conversation?
You know, I know that there was a lot of action by the KC Tenants Group recently.
Yes. And ongoing.
And some big votes and some big decisions on affordable housing plans. I would say that Kansas City just strikes me as a city that fits into, you know, some of the patterns we're seeing in a lot of cities across the country. You look at a place like Salt Lake City, a place like Denver, a place like Boise. And, you know, obviously these are all very different cities and very unique cities. But I think one of the things that unites them is that, you know, if you ask someone 15, 20 years if there were like affordable housing crises in these places, especially someone who's from the outside might not see that happening. But now just about every big city in the country is seeing that happen and seeing that sort of crunch. And I think that, you know, this project is an example of the ways that cities are trying to deal with it. And, you know, I think the bottom line is we just need a lot more of them.
What would your question be as you would be like if you were here watching this unfold?
I guess my question would be just how this is, you know, kind of relating to and, working with the community. And I know that, you know, you brought up a lot of examples of how that's working, but that to me is one of the things that can really make these projects go from kind of good to great. If you look at other examples across the country, in Indianapolis, there's a group called Big Car Collaborative. They are using a community land trust to provide lower cost housing to artists. And kind of part of what the deal there is they're asking artists to sort of contribute time to community revitalization projects. So this is something that really helps the community on a wide scale. So I think examples like that, you know, the Dorchester project that you did in Chicago is an excellent one. So just seeing how those things continue to kind of ripple out to the larger community.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Patrick Sisson, David Brent, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
You can grab anything you missed from that discussion later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. Up next, My Fellow Kansans returns. Episode 5 takes us to Greensburg, 12 years after the tornado. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going now to Greensburg, Kansas, a town made famous first by its own destruction and then by the effort to rebuild and rebrand more than a decade later. How is it going? And what's the lesson of Greensburg for other small towns in Kansas? That's the topic of this week's episode of My Fellow Kansans from the Kansas News Service. Let's give it a listen.
If you've heard of tiny Greensburg, Kansas before, it's probably because of the massive twister that leveled the town a dozen years ago. And maybe because of the attention paid to its green rebirth, its attempt to transform itself from just another struggling, withering community on the high plains into one ready to buck the forces that have been driving people, jobs, and money out of rural Kansas for generations.
By going it green, by being a sustainable community, we're looking for green-collar jobs. We're looking for something that sets us away from everybody else.
In the days after the tornado, people streamed into Greensburg to see if they could help. They often landed at Scott Brown's auction company, located just outside the tornado's path on the edge of town.
My office that we're sitting in right now was actually the only building that was still usable for public meetings or for gatherings or whatever that was left standing.
Developers from Wichita, Kansas City, even Denver showed up to talk about rebuilding Greensburg's downtown.
And they'd say, hey, we want to help Greensburg. This is terrible. We've never seen nothing like it. And if you're going to rebuild, we want to help. And I'd say, fine, that's good. We need all the help we can get.
But when, as Brown says, the discussions got down to the nitty-gritty, the numbers didn't pencil out. To make any money, the developers said they'd need to charge businesses five times the rent they were paying before the tornado.
These people, and they were good people, and they really wanted to help Greensburg, but when it got down to the dollars and cents, it didn't make sense for them to do it.
So did they then just walk away?
Pretty much, just said, well, we'll get back in touch. And they didn't get back in touch. They'd go back and talk to their partners, and it was dead.
That, in microcosm, is the story of rural Kansas. Even with a makeover and a lot of help from outsiders, some places may prove just too remote to easily salvage. So I went back to Greensburg to find out whether its transformation into the state's most energy-efficient and environmentally friendly community had worked out, had set it apart from other rural towns struggling to attract the jobs and people they need to survive and prosper. I'm Jim McLean, and this is My Fellow Kansans, a podcast from the Kansas News Service.
Let's go back to our wind part, the Doppler part of our neighborhood stormcaster. And here again, you can see that circulation.
It's May 4th, 2007. Wichita meteorologist Dave Freeman is doing what he does on many spring and summer evenings, tracking storms for TV viewers in western Kansas.
And the track continues to be kind of straight to the north. So if you're in that Greensburg area, we urge you to, again, move to shelter and get in.
But there's something different about this storm, something ominous. It's spawned a tornado more than a mile wide, and it's headed right at Greensburg. At the time, a town of about 1,500, some 100 miles west of Wichita.
Boy, I sure hate to tell you this, friends, but it looks like that thing is right on top of Greensburg. So your time is up. You need to be in your shelter right now.
Packing winds of more than 200 miles per hour, the twister killed 11 people and reduced the town to rubble.
May 5th, 2007. The sun brings to light the incomprehensible scope of destruction in Greensburg, Kansas. It is a nightmarish landscape. The town is leveled.
Greensburg's great tragedy also seemed to offer the rarest of opportunities, a chance at a makeover for the 21st century, a shot at survival. For a while, the town's comeback story captured the nation's imagination. Actor and environmental activist Leonardo DiCaprio produced a television series about it.
We're doing things in this community that most communities don't do in 20 years.
43% more energy efficient.
Geothermal heating and cooling.
This used to be Main Street.
Biomass boilers.
We know we have to take care of our planet.
Wind turbines.
Daylight and natural ventilation.
Solar panels.
Green is the smartest decision we've ever made.
The series finale of Greensburg, a two-night special event.
There was international interest, too. German public television produced this update on the town's comeback in 2010.
The town of Greensburg, Kansas is powered by wind energy. The price of electricity there is low. Maintaining supply is Mayor Bob Dixon's first priority.
Well, our proximity to the Rocky Mountains and the weather systems that come over the top of the mountains and come in from the southwestern United States puts us in an optimal wind generation, some of the most sustainable winds in the world.
The winds blowing around here 3 years ago were a lot less favorable. A monstrous tornado ripped through Greensburg and leveled everything in its path.
The spotlight is now all but gone. DiCaprio has moved on to other projects. And the 850 or so folks still left in Greensburg have, for the most part, settled back into their lives.
Well, I'll tell you, today I've been out working in the garden and working in the yard.
That's Bob Dixon, Greensburg's former mayor. You heard him talking about renewable energy in the German TV piece.
What was the genesis of the idea of having Greensburg come back as, quote-unquote, the greenest community in America? I mean, what gave rise to that idea?
The night after the tornado, and again, I was not there, but I've talked to numerous people that were in the basement of the courthouse because there was another tornado on the ground southwest of town in this massive storm system. And the governor's office was there. It was Kathleen Sebelius at the time, county commissioner, city manager, FEMA, state agencies. They were all there taking shelter. The discussion was, hey, we're going to build back. Well, why don't we do it green? We're Greensburg.
How did it progress from there? Did it just gather momentum, or were there people in the community who needed to be convinced that this was the right way to go?
The answer to that is both. The seed was planted and it grew.
But Dixon says it took months and one town meeting after the next to rally support for the plan. And just looking at the town today, you'd have to say it's been a smashing success. On a per capita basis, Greensburg is home to the most environmentally friendly buildings in the country. Its new high school rivals any in the state for technology. The domed museum now sits atop its main tourist draw, the world's largest hand-dug well. A glass-encased arts center and a corporate-funded business incubator both look like places you'd expect to see in Aspen, Taos, or Jackson Hole, not tiny, windswept Greensburg. But of course, appearances can be deceiving. Despite all it's accomplished, Greensburg, like most rural communities, struggles to attract people and jobs. Much to Bob Dixon's disappointment, the town's 72-acre industrial park sits empty, a monument to disappointment on the edge of town.
We were under the impression that there would be opportunities to have businesses come here and start manufacturing or other kinds of businesses in the green environmental area, whatever that would entail. And we had companies that came and we followed up on them and made kind of all kinds of promises, but it just never panned out.
Greensburg built it, but the businesses didn't come. Instead, something else happened. Not long after the tornado, Scott Brown, the guy who owned the auction company, was talking to his neighbors about how to rebuild downtown. Remember, Brown initially thought he could work with some out-of-town developers to get that done. But they vanished when there was no money to be made.
That's what spurred me into action, I guess. I thought, how are we ever going to build this back? How are we ever going to? We held a community meeting. This was pretty early now. We had to bring bottled water in because the pipes weren't working. And did at least have a roof over our head here. And we invited everybody that we could think that had a business before the tornado and the building filled up. And we talked. It was friends talking to friends. What are you going to do? Are you going to rebuild? You know, they not only didn't have their business, they didn't have a home. If they had kids, they didn't have a place to send them to school. We didn't have a grocery store. You couldn't buy a gallon of milk. We took a poll and said, we just had a piece of paper up on a blackboard and says, if you think, this is just not a commitment, it's just if you think, you're not committing because you don't know, but if you think you would want to rebuild in Greensburg, put your hand up and we'll put your name on the board.
A dozen years later, Brown still gets emotional when he remembers that night, when 63 of his friends and neighbors signed that sheet of paper.
And 63 doesn't sound like a very big number to most communities, but I didn't even know there were 63 businesses in Greensburg before the tornado. But we had people that sheared the dogs, you know, took care of the poodles, that had a business, and they put their hand up, and they were going to try to rebuild and do that. The co-op elevator, I was on the board of the elevator here in town. The board stood out in front of what was the office. It was tore down to nothing and started again, and voted out there on the sidewalk unanimously to rebuild it. 63 people signed that. Now, they didn't commit, but they said, if it rebuilds, we want to be a part of it. We want to do it.
Brown figured it would take at least $1 million to build a kind of strip mall to replace what had been the community's downtown. He wanted to kick off a fundraising campaign by pledging the first $50,000 himself. But he needed to talk it over with his wife first.
I says, this is what I'm going to do. Or this is what I want to run it by you and see what you think. We try to get the money raised from this community to rebuild our own community, our own money. We're going to have to find people that want to rebuild it, that's not interested in getting a financial return. Their return is they've got a place to go in and get a hamburger. They got a place to go in and get their hair fixed. They've got a place to, you know, to buy the basics. And that's going to be their return. And she said, well, how are you going to convince anybody to do that? And I said, I'm going, if you agree, I'll seed this. I'll put up $50,000 myself. And I will try to get people to buy a share for $5,000 a share and see if I can raise $1 million. We talked, it was more complicated than that. But she said, well, if you think you can do it, I'll go for it.
So we did. A few people matched Brown's $50,000 contribution. Others gave $5,000, some $10,000. And when it opened in 2009, the downtown mall was fully paid for and fully occupied. To keep it that way, Brown says, the foundation's board of directors decided to lower the rent.
And we got it paid for with commitments of $650 a month rent. And we decided that the best thing we could do for the town was lower the rent. So we did. We lowered the rent to $450 a month. And through the 10 years we've had up to now, we've had probably somewhere in the vicinity of probably 80 to 90% occupancy that it stays full.
Any money not needed to operate and maintain the building goes to other needs in the community, like subsidizing the movie theater that doubles as a performance space.
Last month, we brought a group from Branson up here called the Sons of Britches. And they put on a live performance, and we underwrote that in case it came up short. And we raised Kiowa County United put that on and hustled around to get the tickets sold and yada, yada, yada. And we made enough money to pay all the expenses and give to the theater, who's struggling. They're struggling for money. We gave $10,700 to the theater. So we're still doing things.
The job of keeping Greensburg's recovery going now belongs to Stacy Barnes. She's the city administrator. The daughter of former Mayor Bob Dixon, Barnes was living and working in Lawrence at the time of the tornado. She returned to Greensburg shortly after the disaster to help her parents sort through the rubble. She stayed for about a week but kept coming back. After several months of shuttling back and forth, she and her husband decided to move back.
I don't know. It was just something that felt right to move back here and to be a part of the community and what was happening here. Wanting to be a part of this community's future.
Barnes has a degree in art, but got a job as an assistant to the then city administrator. That quickly turned into a job managing the small gift shop at the Big Well and a role planning a new museum to showcase it. Now she's back at City Hall.
In the 60s, Greensburg was population was over 2,000, roughly 1,500 at the time of the tornado, now approaching 900 maybe. So you're still not back from a population standpoint, and do you think you'll ever be back to that level?
I don't know. I think we could, but I also don't think that population is the only measurement of success of a community. and its strength and viability. I think that there's so many other factors that go into what makes a community successful. And I think bottom line, it's people, but it's not people as numbers. Mm-hmm. It's people as community and people participating and helping and the quality of life in the community.
Fewer people makes it harder for a town to support the amenities, even some essentials, that make for a good quality of life. Still, Barnes says, people in Greensburg are stepping up in lots of ways, from buying at local shops to volunteering at the movie theater, which can't afford to hire kids to work the concession stand.
How tenuous is that quality of life in terms of the viability of the grocery store, the viability of the movie theater in Spearville, not too far down the road? They just lost their grocery store.
Again, it comes back to people. We all have to participate and be a part of it. That yes, it could be fragile if all of us just quit,
volunteering, quit. Buying local.
Yeah. Right. And I think, in a larger community, those impacts aren't felt because there are more people. Mm-hmm. But in a smaller community, your impacts can be so much greater. And so you have that opportunity to participate and be a part of something. And yes, there is that pressure, I guess, that comes with that that could go away if we don't help.
And so how would you say things are going right now?
I would say things are going well. We continue to work on projects, and even though, there's empty lots and a business park that's ready for business, some would see that as maybe a failure. I don't want to say that word. Because it's not. It's an opportunity.
Well, some people would see it that way, but you don't.
I think that early on, there were probably some unrealistic expectations placed upon us. Whether we had them internally or whether some of it came from the outside with the media and rumors. And then so some of those expectations that were not met were probably disappointing to people here in the community. But in the end, bottom line, 12 years later, we're still here and we're taking care of this place. Has everything worked perfect? No, absolutely not. There's no such thing as perfect. But when you are building an entire community over again and you have hundreds and hundreds of decisions that are being made, you're not going to get it all right. And it's not black and white. There's no, did they do it or did they not? I think we are doing it and we continue to do it. And it's an ongoing process. I think if you ever get to a point where you decide, okay, we're done, then you're dying. You have to keep making progress.
What kind of pressure do you feel now that you've inherited this job and people look to you to continue the progress that's been made?
I feel a tremendous responsibility. Pressure, I guess, or responsibility. Yeah. But at the same time, I think about over the last 12 years, looking back at things that the community's accomplished and that I've seen firsthand. And now my kids are 8 and 9 and it's the home that they know. And think about another 10 years down the road of what we'll be able to accomplish and look back on that these struggles and challenges along the way, we'll think, man, what was that all about? It wasn't that bad.
Aaron Barnhart was the TV critic for the Kansas City Star in 2007. He first went to Greensburg to do a story on the Discovery Channel's series. But he returned often after that to collect material for a book. He's bullish on Greensburg and takes issue with those who say the town has failed to capitalize on its celebrated comeback.
One way to look at it is that it was a failure. Another way to look at it is the entire community rebuild represented an investment in the future. They embraced a vision that wasn't theirs, but which they bought into. They got excited about it. And like a lot of plans that people all over the world have, didn't quite pan out the way it was supposed to. But there's still so much that they can be proud of.
Greensburg's revival story, Barnhart says, is still being written. And chapters yet to come may reveal that empty industrial park was a good investment after all.
All that space represents is the future, the potential of Greensburg in the future. And if you were to build that same industrial park outside a town of 10,000 somewhere in northeastern Kansas, no one would say, well, that was just a foolish waste of money. Why did they build that? They would assume that at some point, maybe not this year, maybe not even next year, but eventually someone would come along and see the potential in this community and build something and hire 20, 50, 80 people. Now, it does speak, though, to a problem that every small and medium-sized town in Kansas faces, which is affordable, high-quality housing.
I heard about that in every community I visited. It's a big problem.
Yep. And before the storm, Greensburg had quite a bit of housing, rental housing mostly. Mm-hmm. Not all of it was super high quality, but the point is that because of it, people could live there. And I went to a city council meeting after the storm where a guy pleaded with the city council to let him bring a trailer in and put it on a vacant lot in Greensburg. And they said no, because we don't want to have trailers in.
It wasn't part of that vision.
It wasn't part of that vision. Yet I could also understand this guy. It sounded like he had been having trouble finding employment elsewhere. Right. And if he could just figure out how to live in Greensburg,
he could stay.
So part of the deal is a business can come in and kick the tires and say, well, this is some nice infrastructure, but we're looking to hire 20 people and you haven't got housing for 20 people. I mean, it's that tight.
It really is that tight, says Dennis McKinney, a farmer who represented Greensburg for years in the Kansas legislature.
The biggest limiter we have right now is affordable housing. For several years, I've talked to community leader after community leader from all over Kansas, said that's their number one issue. We have dozens and dozens of people working in Kiowa County, but not living there. We have an electrical contractor in our area. He's got two employees driving 25 miles a day to get to work. Imagine how that affects what he has to pay them to come to work for them. Whereas if they could live locally, their mileage is less, all of a sudden his burden is less.
The fact that Greensburg shares that housing problem with other rural communities brings us back to the question we started with. Did the greening of Greensburg matter? Is this a phoenix on the plains, or are there vultures circling it like so many other rural places? The answer, as you might expect, is mixed. Though some scars remain, Greensburg looks fresh and revitalized compared to other rural communities. It's brimming with new technology. And the people who remain there know something about themselves that folks who live elsewhere don't. They know they can be tested by hardships powerful enough to threaten their town's very existence and make it through. But in other ways, Greensburg remains at the mercy of forces beyond its control. Not meteorological forces, economic and cultural forces that are slowly sucking the life out of great swaths of the state. Scott Brown, the guy who led efforts to rebuild downtown, would like to believe that Greensburg is now less vulnerable to those forces, that it's not destined to become, quote, the ghost town with the newest buildings.
I really would like to be more optimistic than what I am. We will probably survive the town as we are now for another 100 years. I don't doubt that we will survive, but that's not what we want to do. We want to get a little growth. We don't want to be a Wichita. We don't want to be a Hutchinson. Not that those aren't nice places, but it'd be nice to be back to 1500 again. That'd be a win-win for us. And that's maybe within the realm of possibility. It gives you something to stretch for.
Some towns in rural Kansas are determined to do more than just survive. Places like Dodge City, the historic cow town that for many is emblematic of the Wild West. It's got its sights set on becoming a big-time tourist destination.
It's the attraction of the Old West, the mystique of what Dodge City was, that still resonates with the consumer of the Gunsmoke era.
Dodge City's storied history gives it a leg up on other communities, but something else does too, something that not every Kansas community would welcome: a large and growing immigrant population working dangerous jobs in meatpacking plants. The rapidly changing face of Southwest Kansas, next time on My Fellow Kansans.
thanks to Jim McLean and the Kansas News Service for my fellow Kansans. We're listening to the whole season of the podcast with installments every Tuesday on Central Standard. It's season 2. And that's a wrap for this morning's show. You can catch anything from the hour at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's where we keep all our past discussions. And if you missed yesterday's conversation about Martin Luther King Jr. Park in Kansas City, that was on yesterday's show. I recommend that one for sure. KCUR.org/Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.